She wasn't ready to return to the group. She needed the time to regain control of her mind, of her Threadwitch calm. Eventually, though, she dragged herself back and helped Devrain lay out the bedrolls beneath an enormous overhanging rock. An alert stone sat atop it, searing magenta in the sunset. When at last everything was situated and a meal of hot porridge gulped back, Isolt wiggled into her bedroll and closed her stinging eyes, grappling for that perfect sense of belonging she'd felt in the Origin Well's cool, kicking waters. Yet for all that Isolt could remember what she'd felt, she couldn't actually summon back the feeling. As she lay there, thinking and reaching and analyzing, she drifted off. And the shadow was waiting. "You're here, and you're all healed." The shadow seemed genuinely pleased by this, and Isolt imagined she clapped in the real world. A real world that Isolt was certain existed. This voice wasn't just some mad extension of her deepest fears. "You're right," the shadow crooned. "I'm as real as you are. But look, I'll let you see through my eyes for a moment, just to convince you." It was like coming up from a deep dive. Light swam across Isolt's vision, followed by colors, gray and green, and distorted shapes, until finally a shuddering of black, as if the shadow blinked long and slow, and the world materialized. Gray stones, worn and crumbling, met Isolt's eyes. No, the shadow's eyes, through which Isolt now saw. It was like the ruined lighthouse by Vinyatsa City, but rather than sea-soaked beach, this land was covered in rich shades of green. Ivy wound and broke through the walls, grass tufted at the building's base. "Follow me, follow me," the shadow sang. Though it wasn't as if Isolt could truly follow or move at all. Just as she saw through the shadow's eyes, she moved in the shadow's body. "Where are we?" Isolt asked, wishing she could swivel the shadow's head and see more than just an arched entry into a round room. An evening sun, brighter than the one in New Brevna, beamed in through windows with broken glass, and the shadow aimed for a winding staircase at the back. She moved with a strange bouncing gait, as if she stayed on the balls of her feet when she moved, as if she might start skipping at any moment. She did start skipping when she reached the worn stairs. Up, up, up she spun, her gaze on the steps and thoughts silent. When she reached the second floor, she traipsed toward a window with shards still dangling from the iron lattice. "We're in Poznan," the shadow finally answered. "Do you know where it is? It's the capital of the once great Republic of Arithuania. But every nation rises and falls, Isolt. Then, eventually, they all rise again. Soon these ruins will flourish into cities, and it will be the other nations that die this time." As the shadow spoke, she leaned onto the windowsill and a wide avenue slid into view, along with hundreds, no, hundreds upon hundreds of people. Isolt gasped. The men and women stood in rows, and even in the amber sunset, there was no missing the charred color of their skin, the pure blackness of their eyes, or the three severed threads drifting over each of their heads.
"Puppeteer,"
Isolt breathed. The shadow girl became very still, as if she held her breath. Then she gave a curt nod that sent the view lurching.
"They call me the puppeteer, yes, but I don't like it."
"Would you,
Isolt? It sounds so, oh, I don't know. So frivolous. Like what I do is a game for children. But it isn't,"
she hissed that word.
"It's an art. A masterpiece of weaving. Yet no one will call me Weaver Witch. Not even the king. He was the one who told me I was a Weaver Witch in the first place. Yet now he refuses to call me by my true title.
Hmm, Isolde said, barely listening to the girl's rambling. She needed to evaluate as much as she could with each flick of the puppeteer's eyes toward the cleaved. Plus, it seemed that the girl couldn't read Isolde's thoughts so long as she was too absorbed in her own. Each row had 10 across. Men, women, even the occasional small figure like an older child. But the puppeteer's gaze never lingered on individuals. And Isolde was too busy estimating the army's size to focus on the few details she could grab. Isolde had counted up to 50 rows, and was not even halfway down the avenue when the puppeteer's words cut into her awareness.
You're a weaver witch too, Isolde, and once you learn to weave, we'll change our title together.
Together?
You're not like other thread witches, the puppeteer elaborated. You have a need to change things, and the hate to do it. The rage to break the world. Soon you'll see that. You'll accept what you really are. And when you do, you'll come to me. In Poznan.
Hot sickness rose in Isolde's chest. Vile and almost impossible to hide. So she blurted the best lie she could craft.
You seem tired. I am so sorry. Is weaving exhausting?
The puppeteer seemed to smile.
You know,
she said softly,
you are the first person to ask me that. Breaking threads wears me out, but it is talking to you that drains me the most. Yet...
She trailed off, her eyes falling shut, and her weariness was palpable as she dipped forward, pressed her forehead against an eye-level iron bar. She sighed, as if the metal soothed.
It is worth the exhaustion to talk to you. The king has been so angry with me lately, though I do everything he demands. Talking to you is the only bright spot in my day. I have never had a friend before.
Isolde didn't respond. Any thought or movement would betray what pulsed deep inside her. Horror. And worse, a slight digging of pity. Fortunately, the Shadow Girl didn't notice Isolde's reticence, for her talking never slowed.
I will be gone for the next few days, Isolde. My king has given me a task that will drain my power. I imagine I'll be too tired to find you after that.
But, she said, with a promising sort of emphasis,
when I am fully restored, I'll come to you again.
She paused for a jaw-cracking yawn.
I must thank you before I go. All those plans and places tucked away in your brain have made the Raider King very happy. That's why he gave me this grand mission for tomorrow. So, thank you. You made all of this possible. Now, I need my rest if I am to cleave all these men as ordered. What men? And what plans and places?
Isolde tried to ask.
What did you take from my brain?
But the words wouldn't come. Nothing but frantic, skittering fire came to her now. In her brain, on her tongue, across her lungs like veins of lightning. Then, as abruptly as it had appeared, the view of Poznan spluttered out like a lantern, leaving Isolde back in her own skin, back in her own dreams, and stuck with her own horror. Never in a Dwin's life had it taken this much focus or power to track someone. Sophia had been easy. Her blood took no effort to hold. But this person's blood, with its crisp lake water and snow-filled winters, was elusive. One moment Edwin would have it, then 20 paces later he would lose it, only to stumble on it farther into the forest. It made no sense, and by the time Edwin lost the scent for the 100th time, He had all but given up on the prince. He was supposed to betray the man anyway and keep the truth witch for his father's use. Yet each time Edwin considered leaving the prince to some invisible foe, a strange nagging dug into his shoulders, scraped along his neck. It was as if he owed the prince a life debt and felt obligated to repay it. By the time the trail went completely cold, the sun was already lowering on the horizon. Edwin stood before a black-shadowed cliff with steep stairs ascending to the top. The river was almost deafening here, and fat bats swooped overhead. The truth witch had been here earlier. Edwin caught traces of her scent, but she hadn't stayed, which meant Edwin shouldn't stay either. Prince Leopold was not his concern. Safiya was. It was time to give up on the prince. However, just as Edwin swiveled around to resume the only hunt that actually mattered, a breeze gusted off the cliffs and carried a smell into Edwin's nose, into his blood. Leopold! Edwin launched himself up the worn steps. Two, then three at a time, he flew upward until at last he reached the top. A pink sun glittered over rippling water. Wind rustled through the green-filled branches of six cypress trees, and a thunderstorm rumbled in the distance. Edwin was at an origin well. The water well of the Witchlands. He should have known it was here. Should have guessed this would be it. His old mentor had spoken of it endlessly when Edwin was a child. Yet this place didn't look like what his mentor had described. There was life here. Green on the trees, a ripple in the water. It was almost as if the well were alive. Except that that was impossible. Edwin dismissed it. He didn't have time to inspect the area, nor did he care to. Nose high, he stalked to the right of the well. He made it 12 steps before the blood scent switched back to the enemies, and a slow applause broke out. Leopold stepped out from behind the nearest cypress, clapping. "You found me, monk," the prince offered a humorless smile. "Faster than I'd hoped." Edwin's nostrils twitched. He reached for a throwing knife. "You planned this." Leopold sighed. "I did. Before you impale me, though, I would like to point out that I was supposed to kill you and chose not to."
"Kill me," Edwin repeated. In a heartbeat, he had his knife out and arm reared back. "On whose command?"
Leopold only smiled again. That inane, vapid smile that Edwin hated. So Edwin raised his left hand and took control of Leopold's blood. He halted the new leather, the smoky hearths.
"I can force the answer from your throat," he said flatly. "So tell me who commands you."
A salty breeze swept through Leopold's hair, while lightning sparkled on the horizon, looking at this angle like a crown atop the frozen prince's head.
"No one commands me," Leopold finally answered. "And no one is with me."
Edwin tightened his grip on Leopold's blood. The prince's pupils shuddered wider, wider. Not wide enough. Leopold was unsettled, but he wasn't terrified. That was when Edwin realized he wants this. Leopold wanted Edwin to torture the truth from him, because it will take time. The prince had intentionally wasted as much of the day as possible. His aim since Vinyatsa City had been to delay Edwin.
"You've figured it out," Leopold said. "I can see it in your eyes, monk." "Call me demon like everyone else."
Edwin squeezed the prince's blood even tighter. Enough to hurt. But Leopold only stared at him steadily before saying in a hoarse voice,
"I can't let you find Safiya before she reaches Lejna. She is almost there now, and soon she will be out of your reach entirely."
"How do you know that?"
Who commands you?
As soon as the question left Edwin's throat, he knew the answer.
And by the wells, he'd been an idiot for not seeing it sooner.
Leopold was a part of the scheme to kidnap Safiya.
Fury, scalding and complete, surged into Edwin's skull, his neck and shoulders. He hated Leopold for tricking him. He hated himself for not spotting the deception.
Though there seemed to be no logic to it. It was clear now that the prince was working with the New Brevnans, the Marstaki Fire Witch, the Glamour Witch, and who else? This web to steal away the Truth Witch was widespread, and Edwin was half tempted to torture out the answers he needed. But if Safiya was indeed almost Helejna, and if that would indeed, as Leopold had said, put her out of reach entirely, then Edwin couldn't waste any more time.
He released Leopold's lungs and throat, but nothing more. Edwin would hold the prince until he was too far away for Leopold to catch up.
Yet as soon as Edwin spun around to launch into a magic-fueled sprint, Leopold whispered,
"You aren't the demon your father wants you to be."
That stopped Edwin dead in his path. With methodical slowness, he twisted back.
"What did you say?" "You aren't the demon." "After that."
Edwin stopped to Leopold and dipped his face in close.
"I have no father."
"You do," the prince rasped.
"The one who calls himself..."
Edwin latched onto all of Leopold's blood then. He stopped every single function in the prince's body. Breath, pulse, vision. But not the prince's hearing. Not the prince's thoughts.
"I," Edwin whispered, "I am the demon they think I am. And you, your highness, should have killed me when you had the chance."
He tightened his grip. Tighter, tighter, until he sensed the blood in Leopold's brain grow too weak to sustain thought, to sustain consciousness.
Edwin released the prince. Leopold collapsed to the flagstones, still as stone, still as death. Even the stormy breeze did not reach the prince now.
For several long, salt-filled breaths, Edwin stared at the prince's body. He'd found Leopold, but not the second scent. That blood was gone. Whoever it was, though, was undoubtedly working with Leopold, and perhaps knew about Edwin's father as well.
Edwin should kill the prince. His father would say to kill him.
Yet if Edwin did that, then he would never learn whose blood smelled like clear lakes and frozen winters. He would never learn who had ordered Leopold to kill him. Or why? Edwin supposed he could always lie to his father and then investigate on his own. Edwin nodded, satisfied with that. He would leave Leopold alive and hunt down the prince again later. For answers. So without a second glance, Edwin left behind the Imperial Prince of Kartora and the Origin Well, and as he ran, the setting sun warmed his back and a wind picked up speed behind him.
35.
Merrick jerked awake to the sound of distant thunder and the touch of fingers against his collarbone. Were he not so deeply asleep, he might have guessed the only three people who could have put their hands this close. But Merrick was too submerged in slumber, and his brain didn't kick in until long after his instincts had. He snatched the fingers at his chest, swung up a single leg, and flipped the perpetrator over. His eyelids snapped wide, breath ragged, yet every piece of his being alert. His gaze met blue eyes, made almost black in the cloudy moonlight.
Domna.
One of his hands hit the dirt beside her head. His other squeezed her wrist. Her fingers furled in, making her wrist flex wider in Merrick's grip, and he thought he felt her heartbeat against his chest. that he heard it pounding over the storm-carried breeze and endless song of the forest, though that might have been his own heartbeat.
Safi wet her lips. "What are you doing?"
Her whisper tickled against Merrick's chin, sent a chill down his neck.
"What are you doing?"
he whispered back.
"Pickpocketing me?"
"You were snoring."
"You were drooling,"
he retorted, a bit too quickly. He had been known to snore. Merrick slid his free hand behind her head and lowered his own until he blocked all moonlight from her face, until all he saw were her glittering eyes.
"Tell me," he said slowly, "the truth, Domna. What were you doing with your hand in my shirt? Taking advantage of me in my sleep?"
"No,"
she growled, jutting out her chin.
"I was only trying to wake you, to make you stop snoring."
She wiggled again, her body tensing beneath Merrick's, a sign her temper was rising. If Merrick didn't move soon, her legs would weave between his, her fingers would claw, and her eyes would burn in a way that would make resistance of his rage, of his magic, impossible. Merrick relaxed his grip on Safi's wrist, eased his hand from behind her head, and used his knees, palms flat against the earth, to lift his chest from hers. Her back arched. Merrick froze. Halfway to his elbows, a rawness opened in his rib cage, spiraled through him, and spiraled through her as well. It was as if a string connected their chests, and any movement he made would be matched by her. His eyes ran the length of her. She was vastly different from the women of his homeland. Her hair was the color of the sand, her eyes the color of the sea. Merrick exhaled harshly. No matter how his fingers and lips ached for it, he couldn't give in to this hunger. He slid off of her and onto his back, draping a hand over his eyes to block out the sky, to block out the hot awareness of Safi beside him. Every drop of his witchery and every inch of his flesh responded to her. "I can't do this," he finally admitted. To her. To himself. Then he was on his feet, yanking his coat off the bedroll and striding toward the forest, toward the sea. He tugged on his jacket as he marched. Somehow, wearing it made him feel calmer. In charge. Except, of course. Of course, Safi followed.
"Why are you here?"
he demanded, once he'd rounded the overhang into a buzzing, breezy forest. She padded several steps behind.
"I can't go back to sleep."
"You haven't tried."
"I don't need to."
Merrick sighed.
"Why argue with that?"
He had enough wrinkles without adding Safi into that mix. So on Merrick marched, his fingers drifting over fern leaves or trailing through pine needles. So cool to the touch. So alive. When he reached the sea, when the distant, glittering storm and white-capped waves hit his eyes, something inside him unfurled. Relaxed. Safi scuffed left toward a huge outcropping of limestone, and Merrick followed, though he kept two long steps between them. Then they both leaned against the rock, and for a time stared silently at the sea, the moon, the lightning. It was peaceful, and Merrick found himself relaxing, slipping into the rhythm of the waves and the humming insects. Until it wasn't peaceful anymore. At some point, the night's pulse had gathered inside him, a pressure needing release, a violent heat like the storm on the horizon. Safi shifted, drawing Merrick's eyes. The light off the limestone cast her in a muted moon-like glow. Her lips sank into a scowl.
"Stop staring like that, Prince."
"Like what?"
"Like you're going to attack me."
Merrick laughed, a warm, genuine sound. yet still his gaze was trapped by Sophie. By her throat in particular. Its curve was silhouetted against the limestone, and he couldn't recall ever seeing a neck so elegantly shaped.
"My apologies," he said at last. "Attacking you is the farthest thing from my mind."
She flushed a moonlit pink, but then, as if annoyed with herself, she popped her chin high.
"If you are imagining a more intimate sort of attack, Prince, then I should inform you I'm not that sort of girl."
She looked and sounded every inch a Domna.
"I never thought you were."
It was Merrick's turn to flush now. Not with embarrassment, with annoyance, a hint of fury.
"And you shouldn't assume that I even desire you, Domna. If I were looking for a casual tumble, then you are easily the last person I would choose."
"Good," she retorted, "because you're the last person I would choose."
"Which is your loss, I promise."
"As if you're so talented, Prince."
"You know that I am."
Her gaze snapped to Merrick. Her chest expanded, froze. And Merrick took a step closer, then another until he was right beside her.
"If you were that sort of girl, then..."
Merrick lifted a hand to her jaw, tentative at first, then more confident when she didn't pull away.
"Then I would start here and move down your throat."
His fingers whispered over her neck, to her collarbone, and Merrick was pleased by how punctuated her breaths grew, how much her lips trembled.
"Then," he continued, voice rumbling from somewhere low in his throat, "I'd circle back, move behind you."
He pushed away her braid.
"Stop,"
she breathed. Merrick stopped, though Noden's breath he didn't want to. But then came a twist of Sophie's body, and suddenly her lips were to Merrick's. No, her lips were above his. Pausing, waiting, as if she'd surprised herself and now didn't know what to do. A breath stirred in Merrick's chest, snagged there along with his thoughts. Yet the inches between their bodies could have been miles, and the gap between their lips felt uncrossable. Sophie's breath scraped over his chin. Or maybe that was the breeze. Or maybe it was his own breath. He couldn't tell anymore. It was getting hard to do anything but stare at her eyes, sparkling and close. Her gaze moved down, her brow furrowing, like she wanted to do more. Then her hands lifted to rest over Merrick's hip bones, her fingers curled in. Merrick's witchery ignited. Wind thrashed upward, spraying Sophie's hair from her face and almost pushing her away, except that Merrick moved in. He pressed Sophie to the rock, and in a roar of wind and heat, he kissed her. The hunger of the day scorched through him, and to his vast pleasure, Sophie took it in. She grabbed it from Merrick with digging fingers and a rhythm in her hips that went beyond any four-step. She was savage now. Unabashedly so, and Merrick found himself biting, tugging, and pushing, all talons and teeth and brutal, charged winds. But he couldn't get her close enough. No matter how hard his lips crushed hers or her hands clutched beneath his jacket, beneath his shirt. Hell, her fingers were on his bare skin now. Fresh heat slashed through him. His knees almost buckled, and his winds tore outward, upward. He hefted Sophie onto a low outcropping, his fingers tugging at the hem of her shirt, his mouth tasting in all the places he'd promised, her ear where she moaned, her neck where she writhed, her collarbone. Her hands shot between them, pushed him away. Merrick staggered back. Gaping. Lost. Sophie's chest heaved, and her eyes were huge. but Merrick couldn't see why she'd stopped this storm between them. Had he crossed some line?
Do you? She finally rasped. Hear that?
Merrick shook his head, still lost, and sucked in a tattered breath. Then he heard it too. A steady beat thumping over the sea. A wind drum. Merrick lurched around. The Janna's wind drum. In an instant, he was hurtling back the way they'd come, Safi right behind. Scrub and gravel twisted underfoot, but Merrick barely noticed. The wind drum was getting louder. The Janna would sail into view at any moment, and Merrick had to know why. Had to see how far his ship was from shore. He could fly to his men, but only if he had a visual. Safi grabbed Merrick's shoulder, yanked him to a stop.
There!
She pointed south, to where Merrick could barely discern gray waves from gray clouds. He rooted out his spyglass, scanned the water, until he caught sight of the lights. He'd thought them part of the storm, but no. The image sharpened into a New Brevenan warship. The Janna, with her lanterns and mirrors illuminating the water ahead. The white sails ballooned, wind-witched by Cullen. The wind drum pounded on and on, far too loud for such a distance. Meaning Ryber used the magic mallet and had the drum aimed for shore. For Merrick. Cullen was calling him. So Merrick inhaled deeply and gathered his wind. It charged up his skin, burned into his body. "Step back," he warned Safi. He would need to aim this wind flourish perfectly, need to hit that tiny speck on the horizon so his crew would know where he was. He reared back both arms. Then Merrick loosed his air. A great funnel of wind erupted outward across the waves. And Merrick waited. Waited and watched with Safi at his side. He was grateful she was there. Her squared shoulders and fearless gaze kept him from thinking too hard, from leaping off the cliff and flying straight away to his thread brother. The wind drum stopped, and Merrick readied himself for whatever message Cullen would send. When it finally came through, when the combination of beats and pauses finally thrummed into Merrick's ears, he found his teeth grinding and fury rising.
"What is it?" Safi asked, clutching his arm.
"The Blood Witch follows," he croaked.
Safi's grip tightened on his arm.
"We'll go back to Norden's Gift?"
"Except he follows us from behind, and the Marstocks sail to Lejna. Ahead of us."
At those words, Merrick's rage flamed into being, real anger that sent him stalking away two steps. He had to keep this fury contained, though, for it wasn't with Safi that he was angry. It was these thrice-damned circumstances that were out of his thrice-damned control. How did the Marstocks even know where Merrick was headed?
"I'll fly to the Janna," he said at last, his chest boiling. "You, Isolt, and Evrain can ride east, to Lejna, as fast as the horses will go."
"Why not fly us to the Janna and sail to Lejna?"
"Because the Marstocks will reach Lejna first, and Cullen isn't strong enough to fight them. He shouldn't even be sailing."
Merrick threw a terrified glance to sea, to the Janna. "Cursed fool of a thread brother.
Our best chance is to catch up to the Marstocks," he continued. "If Cullen and I can at least distract them, then you might still be able to reach Lejna by land. Go to the 7th pier, and then get the hell out of there."
"How will you find us? After that?"
"The alert stone. Evrain can ignite it, and I'll see its light from sea."
In two long steps, Merrick was to Safi.
"Ride east, and I'll find you. Soon."
Safi shook her head, a sluggish side to side.
"I don't like this.
Please, Merrick said. Please don't argue. This is the best plan.
It's not that, she cut in. I have a feeling I'll never see you again.
Merrick's chest split open, and for half a second he was at a loss for words. Then Merrick cupped her face and kissed her. Soft, short, simple. She broke the kiss first, biting her lip as she reached for Merrick's shirt tails. She tucked in the edges, smoothed the cotton front.
I lied to you, you know. You aren't the last person I'd choose.
No?
No,
she grinned, a mischievous flash of teeth.
You're the second to last. Maybe third.
Laughter swelled in Merrick's stomach, up his throat. But before he could summon a worthy retort, Safi glided back and said,
Safe harbors, Merrick.
So he simply replied, Safe harbors, before walking to the cliff. Then Merrick Nihar stepped off the edge and flew. Safi did not watch Merrick go. The need for haste spurred her to action, as did the all-too-fresh memory of the Blood Witch. The way he'd locked her in place, the way his eyes had swirled with red. It lifted the hairs on Safi's arms, sent fingers walking down her spine. Safi wove through the forest, accelerating, accelerating until she jogged, until she sprinted. Fern tendrils lashed her arms, spores tumbled down. To think she and Merrick had only just rushed through this same jungle. Safi stumbled into camp to find it already struck and the horses saddled. Evrain was roping the bedrolls to the saddled bags, and Isolt was adjusting the girdle on the roan. The horses tossed their heads, ready to ride, despite their long journey from the day before. At the crunch of Safi's boots, Isolt's attention whipped to Safi.
Leaving? Without me?
Safi panted.
We heard the drums,
Isolt explained, tack jingling as she tugged the girdle tighter.
Evrain told me what the message said.
But where is Merrick? Evrain asked, moving away from the mare's saddle bag. Her cloak was in her hand, her baldric cinched tight to her chest.
He flew to the Jana, Safi said. He'll try to head off the Marstocks.
Isolt gave the slightest frown.
We aren't riding north, then. We aren't going to flee.
With a quick headshake, Safi shuffled to the campfire.
We can still reach Lejna before the Marstocks.
She kicked dust and ash over any remaining embers.
Then we can flee north.
Mount up, then, Evrain ordered.
Safi, you can ride with me.
No, you each get a horse. Evrain shrugged on her cloak, fastening the buckle with efficient mechanical movements. I will wait here and stop Edwin. A taut pause. Then Isolt.
Please don't do that, Monk Evrain. Please,
Safi agreed.
We'll outrun him.
Except you cannot, Evrain interrupted, cutting her voice over Safi's. Edwin is as fast as any horse, and he will catch up to you no matter where you go. I can find a defensible point in the path, though, and do my best to slow him.
Slow?
Isolt repeated.
Not stop.
Edwin cannot be stopped, yet he can be reasoned with. Or, if necessary, these? She patted her only two remaining knives. The buckles clanked. Are not just for show.
You'll get yourself killed,
Safi argued. The demand for speed breathed down her neck. Yet she couldn't let Evrain do something so profoundly stupid.
Please just do as Merrick ordered and come with us.
Evrain's face stilled, and when she spoke, her tone was knifed with impatience, with offense. Merrick forgets that I am a monk trained for battle. I will face Edwin myself, and you two will ride to Lejna. Now, Mount up.
She offered a stiff hand to Safi, and though Safi hardly needed it, she accepted. After helping Isolde mount as well, Yvraine stepped purposefully to the gelding's saddlebag and rifled out the quartz alert stone. It glimmered gray, like the pre-dawn sky above, and as she murmured, "Alert," a brilliant blue light flared within.
"Now Merrick will find you."
She offered the stone to Safi.
"Keep it out whenever your path goes by the sea."
Safi stared at Yvraine. Her silver hair rippled in the dawn breeze and flickered with sapphire from the stone. Safi unfurled her fingers to accept the heavy quartz. Yvraine gave a mollified nod. Then she removed her sword belt.
"Isolde, take Merrick's cutlass. It's strapped to the roan's saddle. And Safi, you take this."
She laid her sheathed blade over Safi's lap.
"Carowind steel is the best, after all."
Safi gulped. That small attempt at a joke had reeled her back to the moment. Back to the heavy truth that many people were risking their lives to ensure Safi got to Lejna, and that Merrick got his trade agreement. Safi would not let them down. "Isolde," she said, drawing the words from her core, from the very center of her witchery, "we're going to Lejna now. We won't stop, and we won't slow." Isolde met Safi's gaze, her hazel eyes a vivid green in the alert stone's flare. The fierceness was there, the one that always made Safi feel stronger, as she lifted her chin and said, "Lead the way, Safi. You know I'll always follow." At those words, Yvraine's lips twisted up.
"You have no idea how long I have waited to hear those words. To see the two of you astride. Alive."
There was an odd gleam in her eyes.
"I know my words mean nothing to you now, but they will, soon. After I face Edwin, after I show him what he stands for, I will find both of you in Lejna. Think."
Yvraine choked on the word, and more laughter sputtered in her chest.
"Thank you for giving me hope, girls. After all these centuries, Eurydice's lament is finally coming true. I have found the Car Awen, and you have awoken the water well. So now, as my vow demands, I will protect you with everything I have."
She bowed, a somber movement that set Safi's magic to singing with the truth behind it. Then, Yvraine Nihar turned and marched away.
"Moon Mother, protect us," Isolde whispered. What was that?"
Safi swung her gaze to Isolde, who had regained her thread witch mask, though not complete control of her tongue.
"I don't know, Is. Does she think we're the Car Awen?"
Isolde finished.
I think she does. Gods below, I can't handle any more surprises today."
Safi reined the horse toward the sunrise, punching down her confusion and doubt, deep, deep out of reach. And, as she guided her horse to the trail, she was pleased to see the mare drag at the bit. The horses were ready for speed. Isolde was ready for speed, and Safi was ready to end this. Digging her heels into the mare's ribs, Safi launched into a scudding gallop and set off for Lejna of the Hundred Isles. 36. The Janna was in an uproar when Merrick finally touched down on the main deck. They sailed west now, the rising sun an angry thing behind the ship. When Merrick squinted at the tiller, right into the sun, he found Cullen, a hunched, wheezing shape who somehow kept a wind hauling in the sails. Cullen! Merrick pushed off across the deck, thunder rolling over the wind drum's boom. An entourage streamed behind.
"Admiral!"
Ryber called. Merrick waved her off.
"Herman!"
he panted, trying to jog, speak, and catch his breath. If he was already tired, he could only imagine Cullen's exhaustion.
What's happening?
Herman hobbled alongside Merrick.
Joris found Prince Leopold unconscious by the origin well. Apparently the Blood Witch attacked and betrayed him.
Merrick's footsteps stumbled. Leopold was here now, too? What the hell was he going to do with a blighted prince? He mentally swatted that aside for later.
Admiral! Ryber shouted again. It's important, sir!
Not now!
Merrick hopped the steps to the quarterdeck, where the wind whipped louder, harder. As he approached Cullen, slumped at the tiller, he wondered why Ryber had allowed her heartthread to push himself this hard.
"Stop this boat!" Merrick roared. "Stop your wind!"
He grabbed hold of Cullen's coat and yanked the man upright. Cullen's face was gray, but his eyes were sharp behind his wind spectacles.
"Can't stop," he panted. "We've got to catch up to the Marstocks. And we will, but we don't need so much speed."
"But that's just it,"
Ryber shouted, shoving up to Merrick.
"We do need speed, because the Blood Witch is here."
For half a breath, Merrick could only stare at Ryber. Bewitched air stung his eyes, screamed in his ears. Then he bolted for the bulwark and yanked his spyglass free.
"Where?"
he breathed, heart lodged in his throat.
"More east."
Ryber gently aimed the spyglass right, until Merrick saw it. A lone blur of white streaming down the seaside road. Merrick slid the glass further east until... there. Two figures. One in white and one in black on horseback. They coursed down the same road, and the Blood Witch was no more than a league behind them. He would be upon Safi and Isolde before Merrick could even fly back to shore. Merrick snapped down the glass and forced himself to inhale, in through his nose. The heavy scent of oncoming rain, then out through grinding teeth. It helped nothing.
"How the hell," he ground out, "did that monster get here so fast?" "By all that's holy," Herman swore, peering through his own spyglass. "Is that white speck him?"
"His powers are straight from the void," Ryber said gravely.
Then she cried,
"Cullen!"
and lurched from the bulwark. Merrick bolted after, and with Ryber's help, he peeled Cullen's white-knuckled hand off the tiller. Then he slid his arm beneath his thread brother's. Cullen was too cold to the touch, his clothes too damp with sweat.
"You have to stop this," Merrick shouted. "Stop your winds, Cullen."
"If I stop," Cullen answered with surprising strength, "then we lose your contract."
"Your life is worth more than a contract," Merrick said.
But Cullen started laughing then, a hacking, gulping sound, and he lifted a weak arm to gesture south.
"I have an idea."
Merrick followed Cullen's finger, but all he saw there were dark skies and the flickers of distant lightning. But then Ryber breathed,
"No,"
and Merrick's stomach bottomed out.
"No."
He towed Cullen around to face him. The first mate's hair was so plastered by sweat, it didn't even move in the wind.
"That is not an option, Cullen. Ever."
"But it's the only option. New Brevna needs this trade agreement."
"You can barely stand."
"I don't need to stand," Cullen said, "if I'm riding a storm."
Merrick shook his head, frantic now, panicking, while Ryber whispered over and over,
"Please don't do it. Please don't do it. Please don't do it."
"Have you forgotten what happened last time you summoned a storm?"
Merrick looked at Ryber for support, but she was crying now, and Merrick realized with a sickening certainty that she had already resigned herself to this course.
How, though? How could she give up so easily and so fast?
We don't need the trade agreement, Merrick insisted. The Nihar lands are growing again.
Growing, Cullen.
So as your admiral and your prince, I command you not to do this.
Cullen's coughing subsided. He sucked in a long, vicious breath that sounded like knives and fire. Then the man smiled, a full, frightening smile.
And as your thread, brother, I choose not to listen.
In a clap of heat and power, magic sizzled to life and Cullen's eyes shivered, twitched. His pupils were shrinking, vanishing. A wind ripped over the deck, collided into Merrick and Ryber, almost knocking them flat. It left Merrick with no choice. He ripped off his coat and Ryber moved to take it. The wind battered them, but they both bent into it, she aiming below decks with his jacket and he staggering for the tiller. As he moved into position at the helm of his father's warship, Merrick prayed once more to Noden. But this time he prayed that Cullen and everyone else in his crew survived the night. Because the storm was on its way now, and Merrick could do nothing to stop it. Safi had never pushed a horse so hard. Sweat streaked her mare's sides, foamed on his Izolt's roan. At any moment they might throw a shoe or twist a leg, but until that happened, until the creatures gave out from exhaustion, Safi had little choice but to keep galloping down this cliff-lined road. The girl's long shadows galloped beside them, the dawn sun a pale flame over the Jadantsi that lit up a bay so wide Safi couldn't see its end. Bare rock islands of all shapes and sizes speckled the glowing tide waters. The Hundred Isles. The road followed a descending curve, eventually reaching sea level, and Lejna too. After green for half a mile, they'd suddenly galloped back into a wasteland. It was all too quiet. Too dead. Safi didn't like how the alert stone pierced the sky from its spot tied to her saddlebag. They were literally asking to be noticed.
"Anyone here?"
Safi shouted over the four-beat hammer of hooves. Izolt's eyes squeezed briefly shut, then burst wide again.
"No one. Not yet."
Safi's grip tightened on her reins. One hand moved to her sword hilt.
"Just get to the pier."
That was all she had to do.
"Sign!"
Izolt barked. Safi squinted ahead. What had once been an ornately stamped sign now dangled atop an iron column. It was the fourth like it they'd seen. Lejna. 1 league. 1 league? That was minutes away. Despite the tears in Safi's eyes from the wind and the dirt, despite the fact that her heart might rip from her throat with fear, and despite the fact that she and Izolt could be cut down by a blood witch at any moment, Safi grinned. She had her thread sister beside her. That was all that mattered, all that had ever mattered. Her horse rounded a bend. The ghost forest opened up to reveal a city ahead. Lejna's crescent shape hugged the shore, and the row buildings that lined its streets might have once been colorful and crisp. Now they crumbled and their roofs caved in. Only 3 docks still stood, the rest reduced to abandoned posts jutting up from the waves. Safi spurred the mare faster, harder. She would get Merrick his thrice-damned trade agreement.
"Is that Merrick?"
Izolt asked, blasting apart Safi's thoughts. Safi searched the sea, hope soaring into her skull, until she spotted the Nubrevnan warship coasting into Lejna's Crescent Bay. It moved at a breakneck speed, sails glowing orange in the sun, and with green-clad sailors crawling the decks. Safi's hope plummeted to her toes. She shouted for Izolt to brake, and she reined her own mare to a stop.
Isolt's roan pulled up short, dust pluming, and both girls walked their horses alongside the cliff, squinting into the sun. The horses huffed their exhaustion, but their ears were still high.
"I think that's the ship we left to the Marstocks,"
Safi said at last.
"Princess Vivia's ship. It certainly looks like their uniforms, which means we could be dealing with fire witches."
Safi swore and ran a hot hand over her face. It was gritty with dust. Everything was gritty. Her throat, her eyes, her brain, and more dust kept gusting in.
"Why are there so many soldiers on a single ship?
Surely they're not all me."
Thunder boomed from the south, brief and all-consuming. Safi twisted her head toward it, and a fresh slew of oaths fell off her tongue. Storm clouds were rumbling in fast, and at the mouth of the bay were more ships, Marstocki naval galleons, waiting in a row as if to guard the Hundred Isles, or to keep the Jana out.
"Merrick won't be able to sail in."
Safi pushed the mare into a slow trot. The path veered inland. Maybe the dead pine forest would offer some protection from the quickening gales in the eyes of Marstocki sailors.
"That's the least of our worries,"
Isolt said, increasing her roan's pace.
"That first ship is almost to the Lejna piers. This is clearly an ambush."
She broke off as a fresh burst of wind pounded into her and into Safi. They both turned their faces away, blocked their eyes and mouths. The air tangled in their clothes and hair, clattered at the horse's tack, and then rattled through bone-dry branches ahead. The only thing that didn't bend to the wind's will was the alert stone's light, which, Safi realized, she should probably put away. No need to attract the Marstocks. As she untied the stone from her saddlebag, Isolt called,
"Which pier do you need to get to?"
"Good question." Safi had no rutting idea which dock was Pier 7. There were too many empty posts to sort it out.
"I'll have to try all three."
She patted the mare, who was still dark with sweat but seemed better for the walking. Then she led the horse into the dead pines.
"Got any ideas for a plan?" "Actually," Isolt answered slowly, "I might. Do you remember that time outside of Vinyatsa City, when we wore each other's clothes? You mean, when we almost got killed by those Nami-hating bastards at the tavern?" "That's the time."
Isolt veered her roan closer to Safi, clearly hoping not to have to shout her way through this plan. Her hair flipped and flayed across her face.
"We gave those men what they wanted to see, remember? But then the Nomatsi girl they thought they'd cornered turned out to be you. One of our finer tricks?"
Safi smiled tightly, swatting her own wayward hair from her eyes.
"Why wouldn't that same plan work now?"
Isolt asked.
"We can still try to reach Lejna before that ship, but if it doesn't work out..." "Doesn't look like it will." "Then we can ditch the horses, hide the alert stone, and split up. I'll be the decoy and draw them into the city. You can go to the piers. Once you've reached all three, go back to the alert stone. Light it up, and I'll find you."
"Absolutely rotting not,"
Safi glowered at Isolt.
"That's the worst idea you've ever had. Why would you put yourself in danger?" "That's just it,"
Isolt interrupted.
"The truce says they can't kill anyone on foreign soil, right?" "It also says they can't land here, but they clearly don't care about that." "Actually, the truce says no foreign vessels can land here,"
Isolt countered.
"Their vessel isn't foreign. And that's exactly my point is. They're tricking that clause, so why wouldn't they trick other clauses too? For all we know, they don't even care if they break the truce."
That gave Isolt pause, thank the gods. But when Safi lifted her reins to set off once more,
Izzet's hand shot up.
Thread stones, she said flatly. You'll know if I'm in danger from your thread stone.